Summer of 2019 is long over, and while the global cricket churn never ceases, the season of 2020 is already looming ominously into view. That's right, folks, the 100 was officially launched this morning, and there wasn't much to learn we didn't already know that didn't stop Twitter going into meltdown. Here to help break down the launch and the reaction to the reaction and everything else that's happened this week is Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine editor Joe Harmon.
Hello, Ben.
And CricWiz analyst and co-author of Cricket 2.0 Inside the T20 Revolution, Freddie Wild.
Thanks for having me.
Freddie, what is your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is the launch of the 100, as you just mentioned. I was there this morning in Brick Lane to see the 8 team identities and kits be unveiled and the announcement of which players were going to which team. We all know there's been a lot of controversy surrounding the launch of the, or the arrival of the 100, so to speak. And today was the first day we've sort of had an official a launch of sorts. We had the logo that sort of was released into the Twitter sphere a few months ago, but today was sort of marking the beginning, so to speak, and with the team identities and the players being allocated, I think you can see the tournament itself beginning to take shape. And as someone who is a big fan of short form cricket, I can't wait for the 100 to come along, and it was exciting to be there and see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was always going to be Brick Lane, wasn't it?
It wasn't going to be Lords.
I guess it's almost, in a way, do you think, have they learned a few lessons PR-wise? This was in a way like a smaller launch than you might get for a lot of other competitions, and maybe they're kind of trying to sort of get it back slowly in a way and go small and then go big on the draft once they've sort of got it kind of more in order in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's been a sort of, we've heard a lot about the 100 through things that have been spilt out to the media and press releases here and there. And as I said, there hasn't really sort of been a full-on launch. And you're right, today wasn't a big thing, but it was the first sort of event, so to speak, that was marking it. It was good to be there. And I think there was a lot of excitement in the room about what's happening.
Freddie, do you think English cricket needed this? Needs it?
I think it needs a new tournament, yeah, without a doubt. I've long been an advocate of moving the T20 Blast to a city-based, smaller, TV-friendly competition. Obviously, now we've ended up with the T20 Blast and the 100. Whether that or the two competitions can coexist, we'll have to wait and see. But I absolutely think English cricket needs a new tournament of something like this, whether it be 100 balls, 120 balls. I'm not really fussed. But I think a rebranding of the game and trying to take it to a new audience is entirely necessary.
It's got a long, long way to go to persuade a lot of people out there. Some of them will never be persuaded, yeah. However the tournament goes, I think. But yesterday, Wisden.com posted a piece on the players who are going to be available in the draft, Steve Smith, etc., etc. Big names, quite exciting stuff. And we received 57 replies to that tweet. 56 of them were strongly against the 100, some of which quite abusively. One was in favour. And obviously, the people who aren't in favour of it are probably more likely to reply than those who are, I would say, probably just because of the strength of feeling. But it was just a reminder, if we needed it, that the ECB have still got an uphill battle to persuade a huge chunk of cricket fans that this is something that they should get on board with.
Well, it's also such an easy thing to kind of unite against, in a way, even though I think a lot of people dislike it for different reasons. Like, some people really dislike the format and think it's not cricket at all, whereas other people don't mind the format, but it's the city-based thing that they get behind. I think that could kill county cricket, and they're not. Yeah, so I think there's so many things people are against, and some people would be almost fine with 100 if it was T20 cricket, and they feel like they're on the same side as people who don't mind the format but think it will kill county cricket. It's such I can't quite work out why people sort of do dislike it so much and can't.
Well, I do understand why. There's the genuine fear of the fabric of county cricket being torn apart by this, and it being the first stage in that process. And I completely understand that. I'm slightly more on the fence. I don't think we needed something as drastic as the 100. I would have liked to see the existing T20 Blast reworked into a top division and a second division. I think we didn't give that a strong enough go.
I think
perhaps the 100 had to come at some stage, but I don't think we'd got to the stage where we have enough evidence to show people, evidence being crucial here as well, because a lot of people are upset that they haven't seen the evidence from the ECB that this is necessary.
Yeah, I guess for me it's more just the the sentiment against absolutely everything involved. Because that list of players is a really, really strong one of the OCs players. There's nine of the top 10 T20 international captains are going to be in the draft and probably playing in the 100 next year, which is huge. That can't have ever happened in English in the T20 Blast at any point. But people will still be saying, oh, these are all like that, they'll almost like willfully disregard the facts, being like, there's a bunch of just like nobodies, like money grabbers kind of thing. Just because Virat Kohli's not in it, essentially.
Yeah, I think, and Joe said that the ECB have gone an uphill battle to sort of convince a lot of fans about it, and I think they do. But I think one thing that will happen is, I think when it actually starts, the things will change quite quickly, in my opinion. I think, you know, one thing we can be sure of is that the 100 will be the highest standard of domestic cricket ever seen in England. That is, you know, that is a fact. There are going to be 8 teams, a lot of players condensed down into only 8 teams, where we've normally had 18. 3 overseas players, as you said, the names are huge names from around the world. The standard of cricket has never been higher than what we will see in the 100. And I think that ultimately cricket fans like cricket, and whether you say 100 balls, 120 balls, it is still the same sport. You know, it's 22 guys on a field with 6 stumps batting a ball, and they'll play, and it will be good quality cricket. And I think that will be the moment when people begin to sit up and think, actually, hang on, this is good fun, and I can get behind it.
I think that's true. I think a large chunk of people will come back to it, but I think the ECB is still really paying the price for mistakes they made at the start. The infamous line that this isn't for the established cricket fans, this is for a new audience. That was the one, noticing the replies to the tweet I mentioned, that was the one that kept coming back. So it was, I think the question of our tweet was, what do people make of the 100 draft? The kind of stable response was, well, why are you asking me? It's not for me, which is an easy thing to say, and I can understand why people are saying it, because it was a massive misjudgment on the part of the ECB to use that kind of language, and I think they are going to continue to pay the price for it for a while yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the launch in a bit more detail and the stuff we did learn. First of all, the kits, all with their own KP branded sponsor, a different flavour of crisps on each one. Which is your favourite?
I'm a Manchester Originals man.
Is that the McCoys?
The McCoys, sort of a dark blackish,
it's classy,
New Zealand
isn't
style.
It,
yeah, I think there's, and the London Spirit as well. I've got a classy blue kit. There are a few have gone for some louder ones, which I'm not so much a fan of. But yeah, no, good fun. It's always going to provoke a lot of debate with this kind of thing.
Joe, you're a McCoys man in general and in this case.
Well, this is it. I'm not sure about how much I'm led by the fact I really like McCoys, but that was definitely the one that jumped out for me. So yeah.
It's going to be great, because you're going to get away kits in different flavours of McCoys. You could have a sort of roast beef McCoys away and like a Thai sweet chicken at home. It'd be great, yeah. I'm all in on the skips, but for me, the biggest missed opportunity of the 100 in its entirety is that there's no Space Raiders sponsored kit. I think that'd be a great team name. Would be the.
Do you think that would finally? That would be Raiders. The thing that finally won people over.
Well,
would be
definitely the kids, right? There's nothing more school disco than a packet of Space Raiders.
I think the kids might have moved on a bit since then, but
the Southern Brave have got a nice green kit, which would work really well with the Space Invaders logo. I think that, yeah, there's a missed trick there.
I did see someone tweet: Is Geoff Archer going to seem start as intimidating when he's running in with Pom Bear written on his shirt? But
okay, and the selections themselves. I guess this is maybe more for Freddie. I guess there's not a huge amount of surprise. Teams have mostly picked in a way the best cricketing option rather than like maybe the most eye-catching local name, which shows how seriously they're taking it from a cricket point of view.
I think most of the picks were as expected. I think the couple stood out. Dan Lawrence going to London Spirit was a little bit of a surprise. I'm not sure many people saw that one coming. And I think interesting, the price brackets were interesting too. I think Pat Brown at 60K is a steal. We've seen Pat Brown across 2 seasons of the Blast now be extremely successful. So he's been named in England's T20 squad for New Zealand. Birmingham picked him up at 60K, whereas someone like Tom Banton, who's gone to Welsh Fire, he's just had 1 season in the Blast, in arguably an easier role opening the batting, and he's gone for 100K. I don't know whether, you know, various agents are pulling different strings and more effectively than others, but the discrepancy in price between those two was quite interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised also that Welsh Fire went for Colin Ingram over Lewis Gregory. I think that Lewis Gregory just seems like a brilliant short-form cricketer, and also almost the most suited to the 100, and that he's like such a quick scorer, whereas Colin Ingram's in a way more of a like an old style T20 batsman, where like he'll kind of bat through and get you maybe 85 off or 50 or 60.
Yeah. How much do you think the Welsh Fire is a factor there, though? That do you feel as a local icon you've got to have South African. All right, I take your point, but yeah. But a Glamorgan player.
Yeah. Oh, perhaps, yeah. I mean, I wonder if that was a consideration, is trying to get players from two of the catchment counties. And also I suppose Ingram as a Colpack player, who's then therefore eligible as a local player, someone who's sort of succeeded and played around the world in a way that Gregory hasn't. Gregory's a player on the rise, and I agree. I probably would have gone for Gregory in that situation as well, but I can understand going for Ingram too.
You've written about what the 100 cricket is going to look like. So I guess, well, the way to ask it is, Freddie, you're the author of Cricket 2.0. Is the 100 going to be Cricket 3.0 or Cricket 2.1, do you think?
Yeah, or Cricket 1.0. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, it will be interesting to see how it differs to T20. I think it will be quite a subtle difference. We've seen T10, which is half the length of T20, and that's significantly different, I would say. I think there's a far greater emphasis on attacking batting, even more so than there is in T20, whereas I think the shift in 100 ball will be slightly more subtle. But the game will be different, and obviously the added factor of the, you know, potentially bowling 10 balls in a row from one bowler, and in fact, because you can do that, you can bowl 20 of 25 balls.
Yeah,
can be
really
bowled
struck me.
By one player.
David Willey could do the whole power play by himself,
yeah,
for example.
Or Harry Gurney could do most of the death by himself as well. So you know, those things will be interesting. So I think, yeah, there'll be subtle changes, but I think it will be it's adding a new strategic dimension, which is for someone like myself who'd be involved in sort of the tactical and strategic side of it, that's really interesting as well.
It must have been a challenge to put together this book just by the very nature of the short format and how quickly it changes. So when did you start putting it together?
We started just over a year ago now. I think myself and Tim have wanted to write it for quite a long time.
This is Tim Wigmore. Have we said that yet?
Don't think we have. No, I said you were co-author, but I missed his name.
Take all the credit.
Sorry, Tim. Yeah.
We've wanted to write it for a long time, and we've sort of finally got around to it last year. But yeah, no, you're right. The sort of constantly evolving nature of T20. Well, we found ourselves referring to T20 and then sort of at times saying short form cricket, because obviously there are various types of short form cricket now. But no, yeah, it's always something we've wanted to write. Tim and I have followed T20 cricket particularly closely. And yeah, and it was great to sort of, well, I think we ended up writing it really because we were trying to find a book that told us the story of T20 cricket, and we realised there wasn't one out there. So we thought, well, maybe we could do it, and we have.
And you guys, and to your credit, you and Tim particularly have been right at the kind of front of that sort of new breed of cricket journalist who perhaps some of the older guard didn't necessarily take T20 that seriously at the start.
Yeah.
And you did you get into it primarily as a fan because you just really enjoyed it, or did you see a niche in the market from a journalistic point of view?
It's a bit of both. I remember when T20 started way back in 2003-04 and I was just a kid at school, it was just great fun immediately, and suddenly all of my mates were taking an interest in cricket in a way that they didn't before because T20 was so much more accessible. So from that perspective as a fan, I've always sort of enjoyed it, and I remember loving the original IPL and the sort of the fun of players, you know, building your dream team. But then yeah, I think also you recognise as well that not many sections of the media take T20 cricket seriously. We're seeing exactly the same thing with the 100 now, and I expect that will change because the 100 will probably be popular and people will get behind it, and soon we'll have, you know, more journalists writing about it seriously. But yeah, it was definitely that sort of the motivation came from the fact that not many people do understand or get under the bonnet of T20 and how it's played. And so Tim and I thought that we would, and involved us talking to a lot of people, and we conducted 80 interviews, more than 80 interviews for the book. Because, as I said, we were looking for sort of literature on the game and realised there wasn't any, so we had to go to the players themselves to explain how it's played, really.
Yeah, and the book is, because, I mean, if people are familiar with yours and Tim's writing, it tends to be kind of data-driven, and there's a lot of that in the book, but it's also the story from the start to finish, right? You can kind of get the whole narrative of how the format's evolved.
Yeah,
well,
we were keen, I think we're very keen to sort of tell the story of the individuals involved, because I think we've had, 15 plus years of T20 now, and there are some clear characters who have emerged. Brendan McCullum, Chris Gayle, Kyron Pollard was a particularly fascinating interview in the book. Sunil Narine, Samuel Badri, Rashid Khan. These are individuals who in their own right have got fascinating stories. And I think you sort of, in T20, we're probably a little bit guilty of like dehumanising these guys because they just go around the world playing for team after team after team. And it's quite hard to sort of maybe understand them from a human side. And you know, Pollard being, you know, one who was, he grew up on a council estate in Trinidad and became a millionaire overnight when he won the Stanford 2020 game 2008 and then played a fantastic innings for Trinidad and Tobago in the Champions League, and a few months later was bought for 750k in the IPL, and he's played for Mumbai Indians ever since. And you know, he's really sort of candid in saying how grateful he is for the T20 format, because without it he would have had a very different life. And I think that's the case for a lot of these guys, and T20's created some really interesting human stories as well, as you said, from the sort of data side of how the game is played.
Thought it was interesting to see Pollard being named West Indies white ball skipper the other day, because there is perhaps unfairly a view of him, with a few of the other players of his ilk, as a bit of a mercenary who's perhaps not that fussed about playing for the West Indies, and that's particularly a problem, or perceived problem, in that in that region. So for him to be given that role kind of seems to debunk that myth.
Yeah. And I mean, the T20 World Cup is next year in Australia. It would be an amazing story if Pollard was to take the West Indies to win that after. I mean, like people talk about Gale as being sort of the original freelancer, but actually Gale had a quite substantial international career before he played T20 cricket, and that wasn't the case for Pollard. Pollard, I think, had played 3 or 4 international matches when Mumbai bought him for 750k at the 2010 auction, I think. And you know, he in a way was the original guy who sort of went and said, you know what, I'm without international cricket, I'm going to go and make my career in T20 cricket, domestic cricket around the world. And he has then also had a significant career for the West Indies. People forget that he's played over 100 matches at T20 and ODIs for the West Indies, and now, yeah, leading his country. It would be a fantastic story if he was to take them to the title next year.
Staying on the subject of Canada interviews, Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment of the week was just this morning. I spoke to England's next test opener, Dom Sibley. Well, almost certainly, unless Zach Crawley leapfrogs him, but I think that's unlikely. Yeah, which was an interesting interview. He can't wait to get going, get out to New Zealand, all of that stuff. That was interesting to a point, but I thought it was the start of his career, which I was most interested by. And he famously scored a double century in just his third first-class match, I think it was, in 2013. And then, as happens with some young players, he had a bit of a slump, and then a kind of fallout at Surrey when he left Warwickshire, and Surrey put out a press release, which they might look back on with a bit of regret, I think, and that they kind of, I thought they painted him in a not particularly good picture, implied that he'd gone to Warwickshire because he was promised first team cricket in the top order, which he said was not the case at all. He says that he wasn't looking for assurances, but he did want to be seen as a top order batsman, and Surrey had just got Stoneman and Borthwick, and had been batting at number 5 already. So he thought, well, if I'm going to open the batting, it's probably not going to be here. So he moved on to Warwickshire, and whatever anyone thought about that decision at the time, it's been thoroughly vindicated since. And he's been the form opener in county cricket by an incredible margin this year, really. Astonishing average, racking up hundreds, racking up big hundreds, batting for long periods of time, all the things that you want in a test opener. So now it just remains to be seen whether he can do it or not.
Yeah, I guess the thing with him is that I guess there's two things. A lot of people will be backing him for selection without having seen a great deal of him play, and then the people who have seen him play said that he's got at least an unusual technique. But he sort of that, I mean, that's kind of by design. It's not like he's accidentally got this technique and is kind of figuring out a way to make it work. This is how he thinks he's kind of best at batting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that the technique has changed. That's quite interesting in itself. I mean, Ashley Giles, who was obviously his coach at Warwickshire before he took the ECB job, said himself that Sibley's not the prettiest on the eye. But then, well, you know, Steve Smith is not necessarily, well, it depends what you find pretty, but is not necessarily the prettiest on the eye. Rory Burns, you could say the same of. So it's not a bad time to be coming in playing ugly cricket. I think people have more respect for ugly batsmen than they might have done in previous years if they can stick around for a long time. And on his technique, there's been quite a lot of talk about him working with Gary Palmer, the freelance batting coach who's worked with Alistair Cook and I think Ian Bell in the past. And Sibley did say he's been a big part of his kind of resurgence, but he said actually it was Jonathan Trott who picked out a kind of potential technical weakness, which set the tone for this change of form that we've seen. He said he thought for a big guy he was quite narrow in his stance, and basically he was kind of falling over quite a lot. So when Sibley went away and had a think about it and then started to have a bit of a wider stance, a bit more front on, so he said if he is falling over, he's kind of falling down the pitch, which he said it was not such an issue. And he said from that moment on he hasn't really looked back, and he couldn't have been any more full of praise for Ian Bell and Trott at Warwickshire and how much they've helped him behind the scenes. And he says he'll still go back to those two guys when he does start playing for England as sources of inspiration and advice, and particularly someone like Trott, who's obviously experienced pretty much all you can in international cricket, both the highs and the incredible kind of tragic lows to an extent. And he's got some good people to talk to there. Freddie, when you put Sibley's name through the CricVis machine, does he come out as a successful test match opener? That's how it works, isn't it?
We can't say it with such confidence. But, no, I mean, well, as you said, he's had a fantastic season this year, and he's, you know, in that respect, he's earned his spot on the tour. I think the thing for me about Sibley, or for any guy coming out of county cricket, with the body of work that he's had, which is one very good season and a few years of promise is realistic expectations. I think we've seen, in particularly in England, and England are going to two difficult places to bat, in New Zealand and South Africa next. Batting in Test cricket is exceptionally difficult right now for a number of reasons, conditions being one, a fantastic crop of bowlers being another. And I think we have to adjust our expectations as to what a successful Test match opener looks like these days. You know, Alistair Cook averaged in the 40s, and he was a legendary player. But nowadays, an average in, you know, the high 20s, low 30s is probably pretty serviceable. I think also what's important really is how many balls you can face.
Yeah.
It's the blunting of the new ball. If you can bat for 60, 70 balls, then you're essentially getting, you know, you're taking your team, you know, maybe one down at lunch. You've done your job, really, in a way, especially in England's team, which, as we know, is full of dynamic middle-order players. If the guys who are opening the batting can just simply see off the new ball, almost how many runs they score is not maybe as important. They then lay the platform for, you know, Root, Butler, Stokes to come in and capitalise against a softer ball and a slightly tiring attack. So, yeah, you know, I think, for me, that's the thing. I think I've not seen much of him, as, you know, as I said, people have talked a little bit about his technique, but for me, you know, as you said, Steve Smith, Shiv Narayan Chanderpool, Graham Smith, Alistair Cook, these guys who just don't look, you know, particularly elegant, have scored, you know, tens of thousands of runs. So I think I'd be wary of commenting too much on that. But I think, let's have some realistic expectations. But he's earned his place, and I wish him all the best in New Zealand.
A nice little side story as well, which I meant to mention. So Dom Sibley made his second team debut opening the batting with Rory Burns, made his first class debut opening the batting with Rory Burns. He's going to Rory Burns' wedding this weekend and will likely be opening the batting with him on Test debut in New Zealand, which is a nice little side story. And also, he said he was incredibly proud of what Burns has done this summer in the most testing circumstances you can possibly imagine as an opening batsman. He described, he was at Trent Bridge playing a T20 for Warwickshire, Birmingham Bears. And Burns was on 98 or 99, and he was meant to be going out to train before the start of the match, and he just couldn't leave the TV because he wanted to see Burns get there.
He was on 99 for a while.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? He was, yeah. he just said he couldn't have been prouder of his mate. And yeah, as I say, we'll most likely be seeing them opening the batting for the first Test in New Zealand, and hopefully for a little while longer than that.
Well, I mean, yeah, just quickly to jump in, I mean, I think patience is key with these guys as well. I think, you know, he's got two Tests in New Zealand, four in South Africa. He should have all of them. He should be given all of those Test matches. Yeah. Even if you're really struggling, I think you know, it takes, as I said, opening batting in Test cricket is hard, and give a guy a decent opportunity, probably beyond. You're probably looking into Sri Lanka as well, really. And hopefully he can establish himself in that time.
So do you think, I mean, England didn't give Jason Roy that. Do you think he deserved more at the top?
I think, yeah. Well, Roy is the one. Roy's slightly different in that Roy has hasn't been a sort of proven opener in county cricket, and it was almost a bit of a rogue experimental move. It's essentially done so well in the World Cup, they liked the way that he played, and, you know, it almost, they tried so many traditional openers, let's try someone else who takes the attack to the new ball. I wouldn't have not liked it if Roy had been given more time, but I can understand the nature of his selection. I can sort of understand why they've moved on from him as quickly as they have, I suppose.
Yeah. This leads neatly onto a new feature we're launching in the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast, which is a read of the week. And this week it's a Confessions of an England or English Opener?
Of an England Opener.
Confessions of an England Opener.
Either could work, though.
Yeah. In the current issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, written by Joe Harmon, who's here. Joe, do you want to talk us through the piece itself, and then we can...
So it does feed into a lot of what we've just been talking about. So I wanted it was actually just before Jason Roy started opening the batting in the Ashes. So he'd played against Ireland, but it was before the Ashes started. And obviously he was the next to have a go at trying to make this thing work. And it's been clear how difficult a job it is. And I just wanted to find out more about what makes it so difficult, whether it's the technical issues, the mental issues, the scrutiny you're under as a Test cricketer. So I spoke to Michael Carberry, Sam Robson and Adam Blythe about their own experiences of Test cricket, and each of them didn't have very long in the Test arena. Carberry played the 2013-14 Ashes.
Mm-hmm. And had a couple of Tests.
One Test before that in Bangladesh. Then actually it was Sam Robson that took over for that 2014 summer. Mm-hmm. He played against Sri Lanka and India and then was dropped. Then there was a sort of weird bit where Moeen opened the batting briefly, trotted it in West Indies, and then Blythe opened the batting the following summer against New Zealand, where he scored 100 at Headingley, and then had a miserable Ashes and was dropped.
they have different takes on it. Carberry is the most animated. It's perhaps easier because he's no longer in the game. I mean, he says some of the people who are selecting the team are just idiots. That's a direct quote from him, and he certainly feels hard done by. He was told that age counted against him when he was drops after the Ashes, and he said, "Well, I was young enough 4 months ago," and he did relatively well in that series, faced more balls than anyone apart from Australia's openers, which is a pretty decent effort in such a horrendous series for England. So he thinks he was livid about the Jason Roy selection. Not because he's got anything against Jason Roy, but he thinks it showed disrespect to the role of what opening the batting is, particularly in England, that it's a specialist role and needs to be respected as such. Now, 2 weeks later, Roy's out of the team and Carberry looks like he's probably hit the nail on the head on that one. Robson and Lythe spoke. I think they both appreciated. I think Sam Robson was quite unlucky to be dropped when he was. He thought it was fair enough, actually. And Adam Lythe again said after the Ashes he could completely understand why he was dropped. But they both did say these guys need to be given more time, as Freddie's saying, to bed into that position and have expectations that are reasonable, particularly when playing over here when the ball was doing all sorts. And you know they're both hopeful of getting another shot. I mean, they're young enough to do just about. If they have a season like Sibley did, with more seasons behind them than Sibley has, then you never know. They might get back in there.
Yeah, the two things for me reading it. One was the scrutiny, as you say, which they was especially Robson and Lythe both said that was what they just had an experience for, and that was the biggest step up was just in how every failure was sort of examined. And after four tests, four failures, you're getting a. Like your technique's being picked apart, and especially, I mean, if you're opening the batting, which is already you're going to like just fail a lot just because of the nature of the job, and then you're also having that extra scrutiny on top of that, it's basically just like a like there's almost no way you can unless you're like incredibly mentally resilient that you can come through that without having your confidence shot in a way. And the other thing was actually just the sidebar, which had all the England openers and their test averages, and I think it's so easy to look back on this whole era of opening the batting in England and see like everyone tried as having kind of failed in the same way and to the same sort of degree. But that's actually, it's not the case. And it is interesting to like kind of think back and think who was harshly treated, who was fair enough, who could have got more of a go.
Yeah, so Robson averaged 30.54 from...
More than what Rory Burns averages at the moment in Test cricket.
Yeah, from seven matches and got a century in his second Test.
50 in his third, is that right, at Trent Bridge?
Yes, I think that is right, yeah. You know, we'd take that now, wouldn't we? Yeah. We'd have certainly taken that
and
this
especially
summer.
England won by an innings the last two or three games, so we didn't get many chances.
No,
to
I think he only had 10 innings possibly, or 11 or 12 innings. But yeah, so yeah, I think our expectations have hopefully shifted a little
bit.
Well,
that's the thing, like, maybe Robson was unlucky because he almost came in at the beginning of this era now where ball has dominated bat to such an extent. And I think people now accept, as we said earlier, that the expectations need to be adjusted. If Robson was to come in, and let's say he had hits the summer he had back then, now, I think he'd probably be on the plane to New Zealand because I think people understand that opening the batting is more difficult. Whereas back then, it was sort of the end of the era when bat dominated ball and the game has now since changed. So I guess he was a bit unfortunate in that respect.
Yeah. Well, speaking of how hard it is to open the batting in Test cricket, India have put on 300 for the first week against Africa in a Test in Vizag, where Rohit Sharma has scored 170 in his first innings opening batting in Test cricket. Maybe England should try promoting their white ball opener to open the batting. That could be an idea.
Yeah, and Agarwal with 200 as well. Yeah. So yeah, they just proving us wrong there. But I think the thing there is that, you know, probably of all the places to open the batting, Asia generally and probably India is the easiest, or certainly in the first two innings of the match. By the time it's the second innings, you're going to be facing Ashwin and Jadeja on a pitch that's turning square. But
then it's as hard to open as it is to bat anywhere else.
Exactly,
well,
yeah. Very well said. So, no, I think, you know, we've seen their openers succeeding and I think that probably shows the difference in conditions around the world. It's part of what makes cricket so interesting. He's going to have guys who can, you know, dominate in certain conditions and struggle elsewhere, I guess.
Do you think it'll work in the long term, having Rohit Sharma as a test opener?
I mean, he's a player of such quality, I wouldn't want to write him off, but I would, if I was having to say what, either way, I'd say I don't think it will work. I think we've seen Roy and Finch, two players who've done well in white ball, moved up to open in Test cricket, and generally they've struggled. And actually someone like Bairstow as well, who's opened in white ball, struggles down the order in Test cricket. And I think fundamentally they the two formats are becoming so different. That's red and white ball cricket. That the techniques required are increasingly different. We've seen Bairstow move more leg side of the ball, which has opened up access to the offside in white ball cricket, but therefore makes him vulnerable to being bowled in test cricket. And I think that basically encapsulates the problem facing players, that only the very best can find techniques to survive in both. I'd love to see Rohit succeed because, God, he's good to watch, isn't he?
It does seem that his technique is one thing. It does seem his temperament is now better suited to be a test opener. I mean, the way he constructs a one-day innings, he doesn't usually get off to a flyer. Yeah. He seems to be perfectly in control of the tempo of his innings. So that is sort of a tick in the box of a test opener. But yeah, I seem to remember saying similar things about Jason Roryan being a test opener and then that.
Yeah, the other thing for me as well is that, like, we kind of have rose-tinted views of how we look at some white ball players who've succeeded in test cricket. So I guess the two examples for me are David Warner and Virender Sehwag, who are both obviously terrific test opening batsmen, but have one test 100 between them in England, and Sehwag averaged 27 here. And that's almost the model that India were looking to when they picked Sharma. And I know they're very different one-day players as well, but even if you're like a good opener in some places, I think especially if you're a one-day solo opener, that's going to be, like, in England, you're just going to really struggle unless you're, like, just trying to stick at your wicket, essentially.
Well, and also, I think, as well, Sehwag, well, it's basically the 21st century openers. We've had two, you've named two there, who have managed to do it. Yeah. They are legends of the game. I think Sehwag is one of the absolute, is a phenomenal player, a hugely significant player in cricket history generally, actually, and the way that he changed batting, essentially. But, you know, it's very difficult to do what those guys have done. And, even, you know, Warner, you know, who knows? Warner, who knows what will happen to Warner's
Well, those two are quite interesting examples, don't you? Because Sehwag just continued to play his way, whatever the format, whatever the situation, whereas Warner has actually changed a hell of a lot since the guy that first came through and played a did he play a T20 international before playing a first class match?
Yeah.
So I mean, he's had to evolve, whereas Sehwag was a kind of law unto himself, really, wasn't he, in the best way possible?
Yeah, I think it'll be fascinating to see what Warner does next and how he tries to evolve his technique, because I think will he just about be around at the next Ash series in England?
Well, I mean, the thing with Warner, he could be, but I mean, there's a sort of a storyline here where Warner struggle. If Warner struggles in the home slam in Australia, which I don't think he will do against a Kookaburra ball on flatter tracks, you know, I could see him getting 100 in Brisbane before lunch. but he could also, if he was to have a barren spell, it's not that inconceivable to see Warner sacking it in and moving to just playing T20 cricket. That could happen. Mm-hmm. But alternatively, he could, you know, and I think this is more likely, I think he will come back, and I think he could still play for 3-4 years at test level.
And just interesting to see how he tries to adapt his technique to, and his temperament, I guess, to survive in conditions where he hasn't succeeded so far.
We saw in England he was so scrappy, you know, that he made such extreme changes to his technique. Mm-hmm. And was changing it innings to innings and batting meters out of his crease and moving across.
Completely lost his off stump, didn't he?
Yeah, and then the last test of the overs summed up, he just looked completely shot there, didn't he? So it'll be fascinating to see how Warner goes this winter. I think they've got Pakistan first up, and you'd fancy him to get some runs in some easier conditions, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, okay. So a bit of other international cricket this week. We've seen a men's ODI cricket return to Karachi after a 10-year absence in slightly comical circumstances. The first scheduled ODI to play there was entirely rained off, and if you look at the pictures, they were like almost floods outside the stadium, and it was the first ever rained off game they've had in Karachi in its entire history, which is quite unfortunate, isn't it?
Really, that's quite unfortunate. But you know, it was better the was it a couple of days later?
Well, it was more days later than it should have been, because the rain was so bad that they had to also reschedule the second ODI to be played a day later so they could have more time to clean it up. But yeah, then Babar Azam, who's the crown prince of Pakistani batting.
So at this point, we have to insert 15 minutes from Phil Walker on Babar Azam.
Yeah, if you just imagine he's done that, and then we'll carry on. But yeah, he got 100. It was a reasonably exciting series, actually, for a Sri Lanka team where a lot of the players hadn't travelled. But Pakistan won that 2-0. So, but I guess the best thing is that there's just little incident apart from the rain.
Well, a hugely significant series and brilliant. And yeah, Wasim Khan's done a fantastic job to get cricket back to Pakistan, which was his kind of one of his number one priorities. And yeah, it's fantastic to see that.
Yeah. In other rain related news, there's a T20 eye going on actually at the moment between India women and South Africa, which wasn't in the schedule until yesterday. There's been so much rain, and it happened it was announced after the fourth game that there was going to be a series when India were 2-0 up in the series. So everyone said India won the series, and now there's two games left to play, and all of a sudden South Africa could draw it, which would be great.
Some pragmatic scheduling.
How long will this carry on going for? Like, best of five, true. Best of seven. Best of nine.
Yeah, that's true. Is it just South Africa desperately trying to maintain a record?
Ben, we haven't had your moment of the week, have we? Are you coming to that?
That's true. Yeah, I do have one. It's Chimari Atapattu's 113 against Australia. I guess, I mean, in that series there are a lot of brilliant efforts. Beth Mooney got 100. Eliza Healy broke the world record for the in women's cricket for the highest T20I score. It was a 148 and a terrific knock. But Chimari Atapattu's the meat for me. She's in a way, I think there's in form. There's no player, no, at least in the women's game, that I'd rather watch bat. There's just so much, not passion, but I think belief in that she can compete with these teams who on paper should like be wiping the floor with Sri Lanka. And I was at Bristol to watch her 178 in the Women's World Cup.
That was also against Australia.
Which is still the best innings I've ever seen live. And that was obviously a statistical marvel of a knock, as this one was. And she loves playing against Australia. And she's just a brilliant player, and love to see her do well, essentially. So that's about all from us. I guess one of the last things to say is, Freddie, your book, where should people be buying it?
Waterstones, all good bookshops, Amazon, online, hopefully. If you give it a Google, I'm sure you can find it. Please go out and buy it.
Also be giving one away if you take part in my crossword in the next magazine.
Good plug. We haven't plugged your crossword on the podcast.
someone on Instagram said it was their favourite page of the magazine was my crossword.
Oh, that's a bit of a slap in the face for the editor, isn't it, really?
It's just a compliment for what, in my opinion, in unbiased opinion, is an excellent crossword.
Right. Okay.
And speaking of the magazine and all things wisdom, we always want to be better. We're trying to be better. So if you could please take part in our reader survey, if you go to wisdom.com/survey2019, Joe, there are 48 questions to answer. Is that
Don't put people off, though.
But they're very quick questions. Most of them are yes.
Also, you don't have to answer all of them. So some relate to the magazine, some relate to the website, some relate to social media, some relate to this podcast. So just answer the bits that are relevant to you.
As well.
And cricket in general, we want to hear your views on the 100, on the World Test Championship. And then it helps us make all our products better. And we can use some of the stuff what you tell us to create some editorial in the next magazine as well.
And also, prizes up for grabs, right?
Lots of prizes. Test tickets for next summer. The winning bat from next year's Wisden Gear Test. Loads of lovely bits that you can win.
Yeah, I might enter, Freddie.
Yeah, sure. Brilliant. I'd love a new bat. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's all from us. Thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed it, please subscribe and tell your friends.